The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.
Let's get the show on the road.
Sad story. 98, our currency's collapsing. I'm in Mozambique. I pull out a dollar, they're like, no, we don't take off.
I would certainly have the champagne in the fridge and definitely pool
on ice. Chilled. Always been of the view that we need a sovereign wealth fund in South Africa.
The space industry in the freezer.
As you secure the bag.
I'm Jimmy Mayaha.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Insider Exchange. Welcome to Market Matters, live streamed every Monday morning for your viewing and listening pleasure, with the rest of the show set to follow later in the week. This week we are taking a look at the Trump-Putin Tea Party that took place recently in Alaska. We're going to be taking a look at the thoughts around South Africa's economy and credit rating being mismatched and mispriced, and that mismatch costing us almost 50 billion rand a year. And if we've got time, we'll see if we can take a look at the sentiments growing for rate cuts. That's what's coming up in Market Matters. In terms of the rest of the show, the deep dive, we're going to be diving into maximizing your tax-free savings opportunities and the effect of compounding in that space. And then for our investor insights, we're going to be taking a look at the BEE policies. It's been all the rage. It's been all the news between the United States and South Africa. And we're going to be taking a look at whether or not BEE does benefit South Africa and what we should be doing about the policy. And then, of course, we've got an unfiltered opinion of the week that's coming through later in the show. So stick around for that. If you're joining us on a live stream, be sure to say hi. Jump on our comments. We'd love to hear from you. Shout out to our TikTok community. We love having you guys on board as well. And we're always grateful that you guys come along with us for the ride. We're going to start off the show, as we always do, with our names. I think we're wrapping up the Irish name series. We're just about at the end of that series because, well, we exhausted the really difficult ones and it seems they get easier at this point. So, Si, this week you were supposed to be someone and then you got nicknamed. Your name was supposed to be Declan, which isn't a very complicated Irish name.
I could probably spell it.
There we go. See? Lots of people can spell Declan.
You notice I'm not trying.
But you didn't come out as Declan because the lady at Starbucks decided she was going to nickname you.
Becky.
And you are Decky.
Look, it could have been worse. Could have been Becky.
Well, it would only have been worse if you had a problem with Beyonce.
Beyonce's Becky.
No, but there was this whole thing about Becky with the good hair, and it was Beyonce calling out Jay-Z for cheating and all sorts of things back then. It was a whole thing. It was a whole scandal in the media.
That all passed me by.
Yeah, you were probably listening to a Gaga album at the time. Happened around the same time. I, on the other hand, am, and I'll spell it for you and you can tell me what you think it is. Also a fairly popular Irish name, by the way. O-I-S-I-N.
O-I-S-I-O-N. Ozzin.
Almost.
Osama bin Laden.
No, I don't think the Irish name their children that. It is pronounced Ushin.
Okay.
Got an H somewhere in there. They're all silent these days, apparently. But that's what we're doing for names. And we'd love to hear your thoughts around that. We'd love to hear your suggestions. What should we try next? Perhaps we go country for country and find the weirdest names in every country and see how that goes. Because apparently South African names are very easy for South Africans to spell. So that didn't go as planned. So perhaps we keep moving and we go from Irish names to Scottish names while we're in that part of the world. And we'll see how that goes. But we're going to get straight into Market Matters because we have quite a bit to discuss. Do we start with... I suppose we start with the Tea Party, because the Tea Party was the big news, right? I mean, President Vladimir Putin stepping onto American soil, interestingly
being
enough,
applauded.
A meeting... Sorry, you were saying?
Are you being applauded?
Oh, yeah, being applauded, but also stepping... The choice of the meeting being a former Russian-owned territory that was sold
and
to the United
States. And
also
equidistant away from each other.
There we go.
So actually, no, that can't be true. Moscow... I mean, Moscow's technically in Europe and Alaska's on the other end of Asia.
Depends on how you're flying. So...
Of course, I hadn't...
Yeah.
I forget the world is round. Yes, you can go there.
The world is not flat, Si. The world is not flat.
No, it's not that it's flat. It's that the maps have edges.
Fair enough.
And you think that you need to go that way.
You can just go over something. Okay. So the interesting thing around the Tea Party was the escort. I found that President Trump wanted to kind of make a lot of points around things, right? So having a military escort, fighter jets escorting the Russian plane in and out of American airspace and almost wanting to assert dominance and appearing taller than Putin. I mean, he is naturally taller than Putin, but I think for President Putin, someone who has historically dealt with almost all of the last couple of American presidents, I don't think he was very intimidated by President Trump. I don't know. Just my theory.
It's also it's the strongman thing, right? The whole point of being a strongman is you stand there all by yourself and you are the strongman. When you stand there with a strongman with an army behind you, you're not a strongman.
That's true.
So it kind of like, you know, he's trying to like show off, but was he showing off to like, I'm a strong man, or was he showing off with like, hey, check the toys I got. Like, you got toys, I got toys, we all got toys.
So I think this is, when I look at that, right, what you mentioned about the strong man and almost the ego play is quite a big thing. And that's why I say I think President Putin has dealt with enough US presidents and their egos in the past to not be intimidated or even remotely shook by President Trump's position. And Trump's very much that person. He's been that president. I'm the president of the best nation in the world, and therefore everybody will know and feel all of that. And President Putin comes in and says, well, I still rule Russia, have done for the last however many years.
I've seen multiple presidents.
That's it. And you're just the next in line almost, you know?
Yeah.
So he's got that sense of confidence that he can back up. And I don't know how much of President Trump's confidence he can back up, but that's neither here nor there. The fact that they held the Tea Party is the conversational point, right?
Well, yes, agreed. Problem, of course, is that, I mean, where's Zelensky? Where's Ukraine? And by all accounts, nothing. I mean, it's the whole flip-flop, taco, Trump, orangey, spray tanny thing. So he wanted a ceasefire or there would be terror.
Mm-hmm.
And
he threatened multiple times.
But there's no... Sanctions. This is a different story. But we didn't get any of those. We didn't get a ceasefire. Then he said he wants to go to a permanent end to the war. Nice, sure. No, can't argue with that logic. But no sanctions, no moving forward. So now there's a meeting today with Zelensky, and apparently Keir Starmer is there as well at the White House. But if you contrast it with that Zelensky meeting from back in February in the White House.
Ooh, that Zelensky meeting.
The Tea Party. I mean, stating the obvious to say that it's obvious to what side he's on, right?
So here's the thing. What side is President Trump really on, Si? Because you had the Zelensky meeting. You know you're not going to be able to embarrass President Putin the same way you did President Zelensky. And if you were really serious about ending the war, and President Putin has said, I'm also equally serious about ending the war, would you not stop funding the other side?
I mean, surely.
So I don't debate the fact that countries have the right to defend their sovereignty and all of that sort of stuff. And we can debate the merits of the Russia-Ukraine war or all of that. But at the point where someone like a President Putin says, I am willing to stop the war, provided NATO is willing to agree to not continue to proceed into Ukrainian territory, and you as the United States have a huge amount of pull in NATO, surely that ends the war.
But so if that ended the war, if the war ended on just the theory that Ukraine doesn't go into NATO, and we can go back to the 1994 Hungary deal, which was when they gave up their nuclear weapons, and the whole idea was, yep, no NATO, no nuclear weapons, but NATO will protect you in order for you to give up your nuclear weapons, then sure. But I mean, does Putin then give the land back? And then what about Crimea, which, to be clear, I mean, I can't help thinking that this is frankly, we're waiting for Putin to die and we then seeing what happens thereafter. Because Putin's not going to sort of back off and give land back, et cetera, et cetera. Zelensky's not going to say, well, okay, take half my country or however much, et cetera, et cetera. Europe's not going to get boots on the ground to roll this back. I read something over the weekend that it's just become a drone warfare now. So all of your tanks and et cetera are completely useless. It's now just who's got more drones to throw at the other side. And drones are easy and cheap.
And if you're going to have them made in China, that benefits Russia more than anyone else, really. The dynamics of war. This is why wars are not good for anyone, and this is why we probably shouldn't be having them. But we're going to move on because we have other matters to discuss. The Tea Party apparently went somewhat okay or not, or I don't know. We'll figure that out as we go. South Africa seems to be in a weird position because, according to a gentleman I spoke to last week, the group CEO of the Standard Bank Group, Sim Shabalala, he touched on the fact that South Africa's fundamentals, our economic fundamentals and our credit ratings and everything that's underpinning just what the world sees of South Africa based on our fundamentals and where our credit ratings sit. There is a mismatch that's costing us 50 billion rand a year in debt servicing costs. Now, to be clear, we currently spend around 1.2 billion rand a day in debt servicing costs. We spend more than 380 billion rand, according to National Treasury, on debt servicing costs. Now, that number is only set to increase because we've borrowed more from the likes of the World Bank since that number was put out. So the 50 billion rand in debt servicing costs every single year.
It's like 13 or 14%
additional.
On the numbers.
Yeah. Now, that's interesting in that it speaks to two things. One, South Africa's economic fundamentals being stronger than what the world is pricing, or at least what credit ratings are pricing in. And two, conversation you and I have had about credit ratings agencies and whether or not they skew sort of perception, because all the major credit ratings agencies are based in the US.
Yeah, and I've actually had this conversation on my show around we need, and this wasn't about South Africa. This was more the sort of your Ugandas and the like. Where there's not enough depth of talent within the Treasury Department, and then there's not enough depth of resources for those American rating agencies to really properly cover the continent. Mm. And hence the need for, do we need a African credit rating agency? Not because we're going to give middle finger to everyone else, but I take your point. I mean, it absolutely is, right? Because they wield astounding power. You know, we are currently junk, and in fact, a couple of notches into junk, mm-hmm. and that is costing us money. It absolutely costs us a vast amount of money. Mm. You know, the 5-year, and that this happens to the one I'm looking at, is what, call it 8.1%. It's been about the best level since 2022. But, you know, if that was lower, and if I zoom out, it's been down to, you know, sub 6% in 2012. And that's the sort of, I mean, that 2% difference on a, you know, let's call it 400 billion interest bill
is a lot.
Is a truckload of money. It's basically slices it from 400 to 300. Mm-hmm. Remember, our minister was looking for 58 billion for VAT.
That's it. Well, we found it.
Yeah.
There we go. Mm. And interestingly enough, if you go back to one of our other episodes, we could fund Formula One for a very long time with that kind of money. You speak of the Africa Ratings Agency, and interestingly enough, the Africa Credit Ratings Agency that has been in the works is set to launch in September of this year. So next month.
Like next month.
Yeah, we're expecting that to go live next month. I wonder how that'll affect the global ratings agencies and how that'll affect all of the other ratings from around the world, and whether or not it'll be taken seriously, because like you said, we still need
problem,
that
right?
part of
so
it.
So if they come out with ratings, to be clear, Moody's, Standard & Poor's and Fitch are all like at the same sort of place. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, you know,
equally all based in the US.
And if the African Rating Agency comes out with something that is better, maybe we're only one notch rubbish, not sub-investment grade, then everyone's just going to do the usual, this is just. Mm-hmm.
But then you also can't come out with a rating that matches those, and then you're aligning with them, because then you're just another ratings agency 100%. That isn't independent. So if we're going to speak of ratings agency independence, then we should have some barometer of how closely aligned are you guys? Yes. Where do you diverge on certain things? And there should be a divergence.
Yeah, there should be. And you know what? Maybe we just need to start it, and in time it will establish its credibility, because the concern is, it won't have any credibility. Okay.
But the other concern, sorry to jump in here. The other concern is potentially that the US ratings agencies will try and diminish the credibility of this ratings agency and say, well, we are still the real ratings agencies and we don't recognize any of the others out, right? So that's a very real threat that, I mean, anyone coming into a market, if suddenly the Africa Credit Ratings Agency has more positive views on certain markets, then there might be comments that this is more biased or skewed towards that. But then also the other part of it is, how does it then affect global funding? Because the ratings agencies give you an impression of the country and therefore what you there. And perhaps this is something we need to do a deep dive on around the Africa Credit Ratings Agencies. Because if the ratings agency says, we will finance you at, or we rate you at X, and that doesn't align with something like the World Bank because they prefer a Fitch rating, then it doesn't really solve the problem, does it? Because we're trying to unlock more affordable financing and those other opportunities. So it needs to be a ratings agency that's still recognized and acknowledged by other financing bodies in the world.
Right. And I think it's important that there are more voices in the room. And I think it's important that some of those voices are from our continent. But I do think that it's going to take some time for them to get the gravitas and the heft that Moody's, Fitch and Standard & Poor's has. Mm. But we got to start somewhere, right? I mean, like, you don't not start because it's going to take you time to build up your kudos.
Got to start somewhere. Speaking of voices in the room, we've been seeing, following the latest batch of US data that's come out, that increasingly now we are finally getting to a point where rate cuts are on the cards for the United States. Now, again, this is from an analyst's point of view. The Fed has mentioned nothing about rate cuts as yet. And we've gone from, just for context, we've gone from expecting 6 rate cuts in a single financial year to now being on the verge of celebrating just 1. How did we get to that? Well, President Trump came into power, I suppose.
Well, Trump came into power. So, I mean, but even last year, we came into last year expecting 6, and what did we get? 2 or 3. So, yes, but I think you're right in the sense that what we have got here is a risk to inflation. So last week we had PPI, looked a little hot, suggested that maybe, because the CPI was a little bit mixed, but maybe okay, which suggests a disconnect, because of course your PPI is what's exiting the factory gate as opposed to what your CPI is, what the consumer's paying. And maybe companies are to some degree swallowing some of that. And at the beginning of the year, I was at an Ashburton conference and they were talking around, one of their US speakers was talking about how the margins in America for corporate America were the biggest they'd ever. And he made the point, like, we can't expect that to continue. We can't get more margins. So valuation growth is going to have to come from somewhere else or hit a brick wall. So some of it's been absorbed. But it's the uncertainty. I mean, think about it. It was like, what, a weekend when it was Canada and Mexico who got tariffs, etc. So markets are spooked at this point. And they are like, thanks, but no thanks. And I mean, September, so we've got Jackson Hole at the end of this week.
Ooh, that's a biggie.
Was it the week 21 to 23? I don't know when the 21st.
21st is this week?
Friday, Saturday. Friday, Saturday. So Jackson Hole this week. We'll get some more sense then. But I think, so if I had to put money on it, I think I'd put a little bit on, yes, they'll get a September cut, but only a quarter. And it's like, I don't think it's a slam dunk. I think it's a probability, but not a slam dunk.
Oh, there is so much out there from a data point of view. And if we look at markets before we wrap up our market matters, markets are seemingly trying to wait and see how that data unfolds. Because if I'm looking at our own markets, we've touched all-time highs. We touched above 95,000 points on the top 40. We're still above 100,000 points, if I'm not wrong, on the all share index. The resi is up. All markets are virtually trading at those all-time highs. And it speaks to that comment you made just now, Si, about valuations and where we go from here. What else is going to continue to drive those valuations? At least locally, we know what's driving our resi stocks is more positive commodities pricing. I suppose this will then underpin whether or not we start to see corrections in markets and how deep those corrections start to become. But for now, it looks as though markets are going to say, yep, as long as nothing's happening, we're going to stay at these highs.
Yeah. No, I mean, the markets are not spooked. Look, something can spook them. I can't help thinking it might be NVIDIA results in 2 weeks.
Ooh.
But at this point, all that's happening and the markets are like, yeah, no worries.
Well, while we have no worries, we're going to wrap up Market Matters on that note. We're going to get into our deep dive and we're going to get into Investor Insights. Of course, those will drop later in the week. Folks, if you want to weigh in on any of our comments and if you want to share any of your thoughts with us, you know where to drop them. We've got all of our community channels across all of our socials available for you. Please jump on there. We love to hear from you. We love to engage with you. But until next time, that's been Market Matters. And we move on to our deep dive. We are diving into our tax-free savings accounts and whether or not they can be used through compounding, of course, to set up a proper investment portfolio for your children. This is something that we've debated in the past. We've looked at this in bits and pieces across various segments on our show, but we're going to be taking a look at the power of compounding and maximizing on your tax-free savings account and what it can result in. Si, this was an interesting one because I saw you put out quite an interesting article around this. It's not often that we get written work out of Simon Brown, but I appreciate when we do. I mean, I remember a time where you and I used to have discussions and we used to talk about things before we did the show. And I remember thinking to myself, if we could just sit and just have like analytics from some of the numbers that you put out. And when the article came out, I was like, oh, that's quite interesting. But then I realized I don't have to read the article. I see you every week. I can go straight to the source. So I thought we'd have that conversation. I thought it might be beneficial for people to kind of unpack and take a look at what it could potentially look like if you plan this particular feature right. And the reason we're looking at a tax-free savings account is because exactly that, it's in the name. At the end of the process, it is tax-free, right? So that's a huge benefit in of itself. But But can these sorts of things, if you plan them properly, be used to set up a portfolio for your children?
They can. I mean, children or kids. I mean, I love these numbers, so I'm going to throw it in. So current annual limit is 36,000. If you put 36,000 into a kid tax-free on the day it was born, at the age of 65, it is worth a little under 3 million. Now, some points here. I'm doing nominal return. In other words, I'm assuming a 7% return, and I'm assuming that that is after inflation and fees. In other words, so maybe you did a 12% return, inflation was 5%. The key point is that 3 million rand is in today's money. Otherwise, I give you a number that says it's 11 glinty gadillion Zim dollars, and you're like, yeah, but can I buy a burger? And the answer is, so this is in today's money. And then if you use a simple, you know, on this point, you use a simple 4% rule, which says you can take 4% out every year.
After 65.
After 65. That gives you about 120,000 a year tax-free. 10 grand a month in today's money. Now, that's not a hell of a lot. I mean, you're not living up your retirement. But yes, to be clear, you put 36,000 in and it's now giving you 120, 10 a month, basically for the rest of your life. And you will die with this money and leave it to your heirs. Then won't be tax-free for the heirs. But here's the even more fun one, is that if you, on the day the kid was born, put 36,000 in and then continued until you maxed at the half a million, which is about 14 years or so.
You end up
with some 27 million rand, and that then generates you in today's money around 100,000 per month tax free.
Okay, so your first calculation was a 36,000 once off at birth and letting that run until they retire.
Until 65.
But if you do an annual contribution until the maximum limit of 500,000, that's where we now go from 3 million to 27 million in that same time frame. Okay, we're going to take a small beat here, and it's not because I want to take a sip of coffee. It is because we're just going to, we're dealing with a lot of numbers here. We're going to get into some of really interesting things around the numbers, but, and we say this every single time, this is not financial advice. This is us doing some simple math, sharing our opinions, sharing our thoughts, and unpacking some permutations around what could work, what couldn't work. Please don't take it as financial advice. That's not what the show does. Don't come back to us and say, we gave you financial advice and it didn't work out, right? Everybody knows that's not what we do on the show. I find it interesting that from a contribution perspective, you would effectively only contribute for the first 14 years of the child's life, right?
Yeah.
So you wouldn't have to contribute for an entire lifetime to achieve that amount.
And that, so there's two things here. I mean, it is the power of time. You grow, 7%, and to be clear, 7% real return, and let's assume that we've got a 3% inflation environment going forward, is 10% return. That is not necessarily a hard return to do. The secret is the benefit of the time, 65 years. The other one is that it is tax-free. Is that when you get to retirement, normally that 100,000 would come out and there would be tax somewhere. Also, along the way, you would have been paying 20% dividend withholding tax. If you switched portfolios at any point, there's potential CGT. Mm-hmm. So there's been a tax drag that whole way through. Whereas here, you got to the end and it's like, yeah, crickets, no worries. And it's the tax-free and the time are the two that have fundamentally worked in your favor and created that wealth.
Let's throw a third thing into the mix here. So what about the product? Because tax-free savings can be invested into things like a money market product and those sorts of things. Does the product itself matter, or are we more chasing that return, that 10% return? So if we get the 10% from a money market product, if you get it from a fixed deposit, it doesn't really matter where you get the return from, as long as we're working with the number of the 10% less the inflation giving you the nominal return.
So the product matters in the sense that you, and it's within the restrictions within tax-free, you can't go buy Sasol. You've got to buy collective investment schemes, ETFs, unit trusts, etc. And most of the, I mean, generally, I mean, so an income fund is probably not going to, in a 3% inflation world, give you a 10% return, i.e. 7% real. That's not likely to happen. But in an equity world, yes. And, you know, then it's like, people are railing against, the JSC. Although, I mean, look at our economy, but look at our market. Look at the earlier
case
section.
Case in point, 2025.
Yeah. Then you just go and buy a global. I mean, to me, it's just a global. I just put a diverse global offshore ETF into there. Now, I get sneaky sometimes, and I was buying Resi, and for a long time, it was terrible. And etc. And And truthfully, even with the rally this year, some of my resi buys are not as in the profit as you would like, considering the resi's up 70%. But it is just, you know, I do think that a 10% real return is quite possible.
It's not unrealistic.
Now, I mean, the US long-term real return is about 7%. And if you take some difference in currency, you're at about your 10. Our local market long-term real return is about 11. Total return is about 11 or 12. I mean, these are not impossible numbers. I haven't gone and fudged it with some, you know, crazy number that's just unattainable. And the reason I say it again, because people come back and shout at me, I do a remove inflation from the equation, because otherwise the numbers just become obscene and meaningless, you know.
So interestingly enough, South Africa's 10-year government bond, we're probably around the 9.5% yield mark there. And I bring that up because, I mean, that seems, SA retail bonds, especially if you're going further out in terms of term date, seem like a lower risk kind of setup that you can explore for this. And you can get ETFs that look at that, or you can, I suppose, could you potentially put in a government bond?
So at this point, no.
At this stage, you could do
the RSA retail bonds, but they shut that down. And the reason they shut that down was because at the end they pay it out and then it leaves and it loses its tax-free status. You can't then put it back in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so the point is we can't do individual stocks. But the important point is that there's lots of them out there which give you, you know, I mean, Johnson & Johnson has a, let me zoom that out to about.
Well, we've done that. Johnson & Johnson sits on our wall in our blue chip status solely because of its dividend play over 60 years.
So it gives you 8% CAGR plus a dividend, tops giving you 11.5 in dollar. So you can't put individual stocks in, but something like let's just take the VOO, which is the most bog standard S&P 500. And over its history, it has delivered you 15% CAGR ex-div. Now, you know, we've had some crazy times in here. We've also had times from the 2000s where it's done nothing. But this is, that's why it's only going back to 2010. Mm. It's been a storming period. But the short answer is that this is not a difficult sort of return to try and generate. It is entirely possible to do. And create that wealth. I mean, you know, the VT, which is a global ETF of almost 17 years of return, has given you 8.2 CAGR in dollars. You throw a little bit of dividends on top, let's call it 2, that gives you your 10.2. You don't even need rand weakness. I mean, none of this is
we're not going complicated, right? We're trying to keep it simple.
And that's just it. And it's a whole part of this whole investing thing is that it needn't be complicated. You and I love to complicate it, right? We love to look at Sasson.
Well, that's what makes it fun, right?
I know. And that's and it's what our listeners and readers
and we're being booed.
Yeah. But for most people out there in the streets of South Africa,
they don't like it.
You just go, and the VT one, you can either buy Global on the JSE, which basically holds VT, or you can go buy VT in New York, and boom, it's, over time, it's going to create you some wealth.
So, if we're looking at the tax-free setup, from a tax-free savings perspective, I suppose this is another consideration as well, is would it be possible to then take the tax-free funds and put them into a bank account? Well, they're in a tax-free vehicle, right?
Yeah.
Which in of itself is a structure.
So you could. I mean,
so you could put those funds into a fixed deposit. Mm-hmm. And I bring up fixed deposit because, I mean, they've got differing rates depending on where you are and all of that. Let's take the guys that claim to have one of the best investment returns on a fixed deposit, African Bank, around 12.8% over either 3 to 60 months. Over 60 months, that's 5 years. Even at 12.8%, that is still above the 10% level that we need to hit on that perspective. And a fixed deposit, let's be clear, is no risk. You're just parking your money in an account so that the bank can use your money to loan to other people, right? So you are not taking any risk on any volatility of any kind. You're just locking in your money so that you don't touch it for 5 years.
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. And usually the problem with those is that interest is taxed at your marginal tax rate. There's exemptions, 24.8, 34.5, depending on your age, but this is tax-free.
There we go, right? So it comes back to, again, why we specifically selected the tax-free savings account as the vehicle for this exercise was because in addition to all of the other nice things you might get from other products, at the end of the term, this is still tax-free. tax free. You're not taking on tax drag from CGT, as you mentioned. You're not taking on any of all of the interest bearing tax implications that come with that. Tax free.
Yeah.
So it seems like it's a no brainer. It says what it says, right? Yeah. It's just about speak to a financial advisor around this, because this isn't financial advice, but perhaps that could be a alternative for people to explore. If you're saying, you know what, I want to secure my future, my child's future, whoever's future, and perhaps even, as you said, create generational wealth or the start of generational wealth, because these things take time. And so, like you said, time is what you really want here.
Yeah, and that's a good point. It takes time. It absolutely does. And you know, the longer you have, the easier investing becomes. Absolutely. You know, I speak at the JC Schools Challenge Awards every year, and I always say to the kids, like, you have in abundance what matters, time. And you know, they've got easy 30, 40 years of investing. And with that much time, it becomes so much easier, because mostly we don't typically start taking our investing seriously until the weekend before retirement.
until the weekend before retirement.
Yeah. So there's complexities there. So, but it is just, it's a case of time. And the other quick little thing is, everyone's like, oh, why isn't the minister, when will the minister increase the 500,000 limit? He's not going to. Two reasons.
He doesn't want to.
He won't, because firstly, the fact that 500,000 is too small is 1% a problem, to be clear. For the average South African, that is plenty. And two, because he's giving us a truckload of cash tax-free over time. Imagine if he tripled that to 1.5 million, and we could max that out by the age of then. I mean, like,
yeah. So now you're suddenly going from 14 million, which from your 500,000 that would have turned to 27 million. If we're assuming
you're
the
now
same,
80 million.
That's it. Assuming no additional compounding, whatever, just triple the figures on both sides. You're now, again, as you said, north of 80 million.
Couple of quick admin points.
Yeah,
when 81. You die, your tax free account goes into your estate. It then is part of state duty. You can open one per individual. So if you've got kids, they can all have, you can have, your partner can have. You can donate 100,000 a year to your children. To be clear, not 100,000 per child, 100,000 I can donate tax-free. So if I got two kids, I could give them each 36,000 and fund their account, no stress. Of course, I can move money between my account, my spouse and myself without donations implications.
Mm-hmm.
And it is going to, and there was a third one and it left my head. And you can open for a minor. The fact that they don't have a bank account or an ID book or any of those sort of things doesn't matter.
They've got a birth certificate. They've surely
got a birth certificate. You can. So stockbrokers can't do it because they're minors, but FSPs can.
Okay.
Technicalities
okay.
there. But you can open it for a minor. The guardian needs to do the FICA on it. As you say, they've got a birth certificate.
Unless, well, the guardian will need to sign anyway as the guardian of the minor.
Unless the birth certificate was at that Home Affairs that burnt down.
In which case, we're thankful that we're moving to an electronic system. But folks, speak to a financial advisor. This could potentially be something you might want to explore. If you have questions for us, if you have comments for us, if there's something you'd like for us to look into in a bit more detail, please let us know. Drop it in the comments. Drop it in our chats. We've got various platforms that you guys can engage with, and we'll see if we can get to the bottom of it. We'll see if we can provide you with some context and some insights, but we're going to leave the deep dive on that note. We're going to get into investor insights, and we're going to unpack whether or not BEE still has a place in South Africa and what's been happening between the United States and South Africa in that regard. That's what's coming up next, but for now, that's been the deep dive. And we wrap things up with investor insights. We are taking a look at BEE in South Africa. It's been a contentious topic, at least from the part of the United States. They've called us out as a country on our BEE policies. South Africa has looked to defend that and say that it's part of a restoration and transformation. Now, the question then becomes is, does it still benefit South Africa? And should we be listening to the United States? Now, let's start this conversation with the usual disclaimers that we cover most of our conversations in that this is our opinion around what may or may not be relevant here. We're not saying that some of the policies don't make sense. We're not saying that they should be abolished. We're not saying any of that. We're looking at what's been unfolding, and we're trying to make sense of what has been unfolding in the public domain. Now, from a South African perspective, we've come out to say these are the reasons we're defending BEE. From a United States perspective, they've come out to say, we don't like the fact that you have BEE. Sai, you and I have spoken about not being bullied. We've spoken about what you do when people bully you, right? That stands. That's part of our disclaimers in this conversation. Don't let people bully you, especially if you're a sovereign state in your own right. I happen to think that from a BEE perspective, our anger or our conversation around BEE should not be whether or not the policy is relevant and all of those sorts of things. It should be more focused around how the policy has been used. Its intended use was to redistribute. And we can argue about redistribution and how it's benefited individuals. But the bulk of South Africans have not benefited the same way that the few that have benefited from BEE have. And I suppose that's what fuels part of the anger, is that you sit there and you create a policy that you say is going to benefit the majority of South Africans, and then only a select few individuals benefit from it. Now you're not doing what you said you were going to do.
And there is a slice of people who got, one of the listed BEE schemes. So it wasn't the MTN one, it wasn't the Sasol one, but some of them have worked. I mean, some of those schemes, I remember at Standard Bank, there was a BEE scheme. And imagine the other banks had it too. I got there after it started, but hey, don't qualify. And I left before it wrapped up, I think. And people made some money on it. It didn't help that the world ended in 08-09 and took a lot of the shine out of it. But to be clear, again, that was a small subset of people, and the benefits were small. These weren't the sizes of benefits that others have got. The problem, as you quite correctly say, is that BEE has been used to extract vast rents for a small number of people. And that means that suddenly the people who you think would be a supporter of it are like, Hubble, like what happened here? Like, nice idea, but I mean, not even poor execution. Like, almost want to say no execution.
Yeah, so the policy itself, and again, this is why we qualified it with some disclaimers at the beginning, is the policy itself and the conversation around redress is not what is the problem here. It's not whether or not we need to rectify the mistakes of the past, apartheid, the impact of apartheid. That is not what is in contention here. It's whether or not that has been done and implemented and executed upon the way it was intended to, right? Because by and large, you look at South Africa's population and the stats don't support it. Yeah. You have almost half of South Africa's population on social grants. You cannot build an economy in a country on grant dependency, and that is what has been done here, right? Whereas those people could have benefited from something like BEE if it was implemented and distributed correctly, right? So the policy itself was not the problem. Now, whether or not the United States has a problem with the policy or not is neither here nor there. Yeah. It's not for them to be able to dictate.
We have a problem with the United States.
That's it. Everybody has a problem with everybody else in some way, shape, or form in terms of country. It is not for the United States to come to South Africa and say, we demand that you do this, 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 and this. We don't work for them, right? It's nice to have relationships with countries. It's nice to be civil and cordial with countries. But let's be clear, if we are addressing matters for ourselves in our country, that is for us to do as a country. So the policy itself, not the issue, never was
just
the issue.
Then we just messed it up.
That's it. And now that it's been messed up, right, you've got a situation where terms like CADA deployment come out, terms like state capture come out, terms where people are suddenly saying, but only a select few have benefited from this policy. And now our anger is to say, maybe the policy was wrong.
Yeah. And it goes back to, I don't think some people do. I don't think the policy was the problem. It was the implementation. And you know, if we had known what we knew 30 years ago, we would have come up with a trough-free eating process. I don't know how we would have done that. But the point is that it hasn't worked. It hasn't done what it said in the sticker. And that's because of the implementation. It undoubtedly probably has worked in some areas. As I said, staff at the banks and many of the other listed corporates did some schemes, etc. But it hasn't, thinking around communities, around mines, and how we thought that it would help them. And, well, it hasn't. I mean, I forget even what anniversary it is, 13th anniversary of Marikana was just the other week. And if you go out to that Lonmin mine, which is now Sibanye Stillwater, I mean, the community around that mine is no better off. Like, they're still not happening. I mean, it's been immensely badly put together and processed. And some of it, is because it depends the whens and the wheres in the house. You know, for example, the Sasol one, was it the Sol BEE1 strike was 600. And at that time, you know, oil was 120 and going to the moon. And we didn't see what was coming down the line. And they were built with only good times in mind, not global financial crises and oil at minus and all the other bits and pieces that complicated issues. That all said, I think that's the smaller problem. I think the bigger problem is that it was some people really did well and the vast majority got.
Yeah, I mean, and you can sort of identify kind of a lot of the political side of things that have benefited from this, some of the businesses that have benefited from these sorts of policies, mm-hmm. and how the policies in reality mm-hmm. been manipulated more than what it should have been. Now, the question then becomes, and I suppose this is what we can also throw out to our community, is how would we fix the problem, right? If implementation is the problem, if rolling out the policy is the problem and not the policy itself. How do we roll it out in such a way that it is equitable, it is properly implemented, and it does benefit the vast majority of people? And I guess that's part of the question that needs to be answered at this point.
So almost, and let's pretend for a moment that we don't have, that let's pretend we never needed a Zondo Commission because that state capture and corruption wasn't how big it was. Mm-hmm. We almost flip it on the other side and we say that BEE is that actually the state gets it and then the state uses that money to, you know, so they get the 26% of mining companies and mm-hmm. whatever, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. Mm-hmm. And they then use the proceeds of that either by selling down or dividends, et cetera, to lower our interest bill as a country, to lower our tax rates, to lower our VAT, in other words, to benefit everyone. Now, the argument would be that the 1%ers will benefit more than the poor. And that's not wrong. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. know what the solution is to that. But I don't know how we rehabilitate it.
That's the question. That's what we're going to leave out to our community. Please share your thoughts with us around that. We'd love to hear your opinions on that. We're going to get into our wall. We're going to make some adjustments to the wall. And then we're going to wrap things up with a unfiltered opinion because we owe it to you to do that. The wall, we're not really adjusting too much on the wall. I just need to double check whether or not we have United Healthcare on the wall. That's the one stock we're looking at. But while we do that, let's start with Sasol. Si, you've been off the Sasol train forever. Pietri's been on the train, crashed with the train, gotten back on the train. We're back on the rails. Everything seems to be in order. But Sasol gave us a trading update last week, and the market just ate that up.
Yeah, so remember they gave us a production update, and the market hated it. And the reason why was because it didn't have any proper numbers in it. Now we've got some numbers, and there were some important things there. And the key thing, the first thing I did, and this is a trick which I always do, when you get full year numbers, go look at half year to see what the second half was.
Yes.
H2 was stronger than H1. They did 14 and change in H1. They're going to do somewhere between 17 or 20 in H2. So second half was a whole lot better. There's a lot that is going right. And you know, the Transnet money is not in the numbers because HEPS doesn't do Transnet money because that's one off. So it's just like, hello, mm-hmm. it goes to the
bank. But it is still 4 billion.
But it is still 4 billion and it is still there and it's still you and I and the viewers out there, listeners paid for it. So because they're getting bailouts and their bailouts come from us. The thing is that it's taken a long time to get here, but Sasol is looking a lot better than it has in a long time. Now, it still needs the chemical, globally, chemicals to sort of come to the party and start getting working better. The question is then, so if you're a JSE investor, is Sasol worth the gander? At this point, I think it probably is. I mean, it's on a PE of around 3. It is certainly cheap. Is it offering value? Well, the value is kind of okay, but not thrilling. But certainly there is an argument that you can say, hey, maybe it's time to have a good hard look at Sasol. I know you could have bought it at 50 and now instead you're buying
I was just going to say, so I'm pulling up a chart of Sasol at the moment for those that aren't watching us. And I remember when we had this conversation and it was around the 55 Rand mark, I was on the Sasol train saying, you know what, for the size of company that it is, for the drama that it's got and everything that it's had to weather, this 55 Rand level makes sense. And now we're at 98, almost 100 Rand, having touched above 100 Rand, and the share price has rebounded quite nicely.
And we're back where we were in Jan. Trick is, My question then, and this 100 rand level is an important threshold to break through, and I would look for that. And to your point, you and Petri are the oaks who go rushing in when the sharks are there. Me, I'm much more careful. I like to see a bigger moat. If you are buying if you're buying Sasol because you think that chemicals are going to turn and do a whole lot better, et cetera, et cetera, and chemical companies the world over are struggling, is Sasol the best in the world? And the answer is no. I'm not even sure it's in the top half. I'm not even sure. It might be in the bottom quarter. In other words, you're buying the classic cigar butt, and I think there's better quality out there. To which people are like, well, what are they? And I don't know. I'm not close enough to it. But short answer, I mean, Sasol is suddenly on my radar. And I know some oaks are like, no, but I'm taking my 80% profit and running. Kudos to you.
Yeah, look, it's one of those interesting things. It's now because you've seen it move, you've seen it bounce. Where do you go from here? And for context, coming out of pandemic 2022, on Sasol, before the big decline on Sasol and the chemicals prices coming down so much, Sasol was above 400 rand. Around, we got as high as 400 rand. Before that, we got closer to 600 rand. So that's an interesting stock. I think we'll adjust it on our wall. United Healthcare, I want to quickly decide what we do with it, only on the basis that Warren Buffett has come out with that. He's put that out and said that, hey, lovely, this is what I'm going back into. The market's absolutely losing their minds. Everybody's like, oh, cool, if Warren's done it, we must all do it.
Of course, but it might have been Greg and not Warren, but hey, semantics.
That's it. But now, nobody cashed out of all of their investments when Warren was liquidating and going into cash. But suddenly when he buys into a stock, the market, or when Berkshire buys into a stock, the market's like, okay, cool, then that's where we're all going now. Is that something that, I mean, we've looked at the healthcare market. We don't particularly like pharmaceuticals and healthcare. United Healthcare has had their own issues as well in the past. How do we feel about it at the moment?
Look, this stock is cheap by all metrics. Dividend yield's almost 3, PE's 13, although forward is 19 because they expect a decrease in earnings per share, but that will recover. Price to book 3, which is probably reasonable for that sort of stock. I don't like healthcare, and I don't like that where they are in the healthcare space. I think that Trump, for all his promises, is probably not going to do much about it because he just waves his arms and then goes and changes his nappy. But I do think that politicians the world over are looking at healthcare and the inflation that we've seen, and we're going to see more hard questions coming. And that's my biggest stickling block. And can it recover? Sure. I mean, can it go back to the levels it was? I need to pull up the chart, the $600 from the 300. I mean, practically, yes. It's going to be a long road. And the fact that Warren Buffett's bounced in doesn't massively necessarily throw me. They've got some serious problems in the business, and they keep on getting more investigations coming, and I'm still not thrilled by it.
Folks, notice how Simon and I keep referring to ourselves, because these are our opinions. Yes, we'd love to hear yours. Yes, we'd love to engage with you on your thoughts around this. But this is not financial advice. I feel like we need to keep reminding people of these things these days. These are just our opinions. These are our thoughts around it. And that's where we're going to leave this week's conversation. Before we go, as we always do, we've got an unfiltered opinion of the week for you. This week's unfiltered opinion is...
So it turns out that you can't buy alcohol in Joburg on Sundays after 3:30. Now, I need some backstory here. I used to live in KZN where you couldn't buy alcohol after 3 o'clock on a Saturday. Like, Sundays were like no alcohol. And of course, there's no wine farms in Cape Town. So it's not like you can go to a wine farm and drink. Anyway, yesterday, when my wife and I moved to Joburg, we used to buy alcohol on a Sunday because we could, not because we were thirsty. Yesterday, I needed a little bit of whiskey, a little bit of wine. I come to my local Checkers. I'm wondering why they've closed off the alcohol section. I'm trying to open the doors and stuff, and some lady says, turns out you can't buy alcohol after 3:30 on a Sunday in Joburg from a liquor store. Now, I had to specify the liquor store part because there's a T's and C's here. But like, come on, guys. Like, this is solving our drinking problem by just making sales impossible so I can't have a little whiskey with my dinner after a busy day out in Michaelisburg. Turns out there are solutions to not being able to buy alcohol.
What was the solution,
sir? Well, in this case, you go to a restaurant where you know the proprietor and he gives you a bottle and you replace it tomorrow.
That is not advice either. We're not saying do that. But that's our unfiltered opinion of the week. We're going to leave the show on that note. Remember, investing isn't hard. Just try it. The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.